Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Today, we're embarking on a journey into somewhat uncharted territory compared to our usual discussions. Instead of examining a modernized version of an ancient text, we'll delve into a topic that many of us find fascinating, the complexities of Roman politics. I hope you will find this exploration both enlightening and engaging, and I'm thrilled to have you all on board. Your thoughts and comments are not just welcomed, but eagerly anticipated. Now, before we dive deep into the heart of Roman political life, I want to lay down an important disclaimer. What we're about to discuss involves a hefty dose of speculation and interpretation. Ancient Roman politics operated in a context very different from ours today. Different values, different social structures, different challenges. Not only that, but Rome existed for about 1,000 years, and throughout this extensive period, its political landscape continually was under constant transformation. This means we're dealing with a vast, varied, and often contradictory historical record, although we'll mostly be focusing on the period leading up to the transition from republic to empire. So, while we do draw some parallels to modern political ideologies, remember, these comparisons are more about sparking thought and understanding broader themes rather than drawing direct lines. That being said, thanks to the gigantic library of Roman texts and later research, we have a lot of data that reveals recurring patterns and conflicts in Roman political life, including issues like class structure, economic systems, and military ambitions. Furthermore, the evolution of Roman law and governance provides critical clues. As Rome underwent its transformation from a republic to an empire, the shifts in legal and administrative structures shed light on the underlying political tensions and aspirations that fueled this change. Equally important is the consideration of the actions and rhetoric of prominent Roman figures. Their speeches, decisions, and policies says a lot about the dominant political ideologies of their time. By synthesizing these varied elements, we have developed a framework that categorizes Roman political thought into four distinct but interconnected political schisms that function as the foundation of distinct ideologies. In the bustling streets and grand forums of ancient Rome, two major political forces were at play, shaping the very fabric of the Republic. These were not formal parties as we know them today, but rather ideological or cultural currents that drove the heart of Roman politics. On one side we had the populares. These were the voices of the people, the ancient world's answer to what we might now call progressive thinkers. Not to be confused with the popular and somewhat skewed understanding of the term progressivism. The populares challenged the status quo, advocating for reforms that resonated with the common citizen, the plebeians. Imagine the populares as the early champions of the people's rights, pushing for a more politically egalitarian Roman society. Their ideas were radical for the time. They wanted to give more power to the common man. While the Romans didn't really have political parties, a hypothetical populare political program would include demands like these. Increase the power and influence of the popular assemblies in government decisions. Redistribute land to the poorer citizens, especially to small farmers and veterans. Implement policies to reduce economic inequality, like providing subsidies or welfare benefits to the lower class. Enact measures to alleviate the burden of debt on common citizens, possibly including debt forgiveness. Open more political positions to non-aristocrats, reducing the exclusive hold of the patricians on political power. Advocate for laws that protect the rights of the common people and ensure fair treatment in the legal system. Ensure a stable supply of affordable grain to the urban poor to prevent hunger and social unrest. Provide better support and rewards for soldiers, who were often from the lower classes. Invest in infrastructure and public works projects to create jobs and improve living conditions in Rome. Implement policies to reduce corruption in government, ensuring that public officials act in the interest of the populace. Much like today, a significant portion of the wealth in ancient Rome was accumulated by the elite, often as a result of state actions and policies. This accumulation wasn't just about market dynamics, it was deeply intertwined with political power and decisions made at the highest levels. So populares weren't just pushing what we'd see today as socialist policies. They would also have been appealing to many who believed in individual economic freedom, those who today would be labelled libertarians. For example, many populares wanted to privatise state-owned land by distributing it to poor farmers and veterans, and their policies were generally a challenge to the state-backed economic privileges of the elite. It was a call for a more level playing field where wealth wasn't just accessible to the few who had the state on their side. Famous figures like Julius Caesar and the Gracchus brothers championed these causes. The Gracchus brothers, for instance, became almost legendary for their attempts at land reform, challenging the elite's grip on wealth and power. And Caesar was the popular superstar, implementing various reforms to curb the Senate's power and support the less fortunate. On the other side of this political divide were the optimates. These were the guardians of the status quo, the conservative wing of Roman politics, so to speak. Think of them as the defenders of traditional Roman values and the interests of the elite class. They upheld the structures that kept them in power and were wary of any reforms that threatened their status. Their political program would have been all about maintaining the established order, strengthen and uphold the traditional power and authority of the Senate in governing Rome, preserve the political and social privileges of the patrician class, ensuring their continued influence in public affairs, protect the economic interests of the wealthy and landowning classes, including property rights and economic policies favourable to large landowners, oppose large-scale wealth redistribution policies and extensive public welfare programmes, emphasise maintaining social order and stability, possibly through stricter laws and enforcement, implement conservative fiscal policies, avoiding excessive public spending and maintaining a stable state treasury, maintain the tradition of patricians holding key political and religious offices, ensuring experienced and elite leadership, foster alliances and networks among the elite to consolidate power and influence in Roman politics and society, uphold traditional Roman values, customs and religious practices, aligning with the conservative ethos of the class. Figures like Cato the Younger and Sulla embodied these ideals. Cato was a staunch defender of the Senate's authority and a critic of populist leaders, while Sulla's march on Rome was a dramatic assertion of the optimates power. This ideological tug of war between the populares and the optimates wasn't just political theatre. It was a fundamental debate about who should hold power in Rome and how that power should be used. These factions were the basis for intense political disagreements within Rome, each fighting for control, each with their vision for Rome's future. Another profound debate raged in Rome, one that would eventually reshape the entire Roman world. This was the clash between imperial and republican ideals, a dispute over the very nature of how Rome should be governed. The republican side of this divide harkened back to the early days of Rome after the overthrow of the kings. The Republic wasn't a democracy as we understand it today, but it was a bold experiment in shared governance. The Roman Republic was a system of elected officials, a Senate composed of Rome's most distinguished leaders, and a complex framework of checks and balances. It was a system where power was meant to be distributed, not concentrated. At least that was the idea. Republican proponents cherished this model. They saw it as the embodiment of Roman values, liberty, duty, and the rule of law. To them, the Republic was more than a government. It was the heart of Roman identity. Figures like Cicero stand out here. An eloquent orator and philosopher, Cicero was a vocal advocate for the Republic, championing its values and warning against the dangers of concentrated power. But as Rome expanded and faced internal and external pressures, another vision gained traction, the imperial vision. The shift towards empire marked a dramatic turn in Roman governance. From a system of many leaders, Rome moved to the rule of one, the emperor. This wasn't just a change in leadership, it was a fundamental transformation in the way Rome operated. The emperor held supreme authority, a figure who stood above the traditional checks and balances of the republic. The proponents of imperial rule argued that such a system was necessary. They saw it as a means to bring stability and efficiency, especially during times of crisis and turmoil. An emperor could make decisions swiftly, implement policies without the quagmire of Senate debates, and ideally, unify Rome under a strong central figure. Augustus Caesar, the first Roman emperor, is the most iconic representation of this ideology. He carefully transitioned Rome from republic to empire, presenting himself not as a dictator, but as a guardian of Roman peace and stability. Under his rule, Rome experienced relative peace and prosperity, but at the cost of the republican ideals of shared governance. Continuing our journey through the political landscapes of ancient Rome, we come to another pivotal theme that shaped the Roman state and its history, the debate between military expansionism and stability. This debate was not just about strategies or conquests, it was about the very soul and direction of Rome. Military expansionism in Rome was a dynamic and often glorified pursuit. Rome, a civilization built in part on its military prowess, saw many of its leaders advocating for and engaging in territorial expansion. This wasn't just about land. It was about wealth, power, glory, and the security of the Roman state. Think of leaders like Julius Caesar, whose campaigns in Gaul greatly expanded Rome's territories and filled its coffers, or Pompey, who extended Roman influence in the east. This influx of wealth wasn't just a bonus, it became a crucial part of the Roman economy, not to mention individual fortunes. The state organized and sponsored the production of military supplies, essential for equipping the vast Roman legions. This economic dependence on warfare created a cycle where continued expansion seemed almost necessary for maintaining Rome's economic health and political stability. The military was also a key pathway to political power. Many Roman politicians were military leaders, and their successes on the battlefield were a ticket to influence and authority within the state. Think of Julius Caesar, whose military conquests in Gaul propelled him to the forefront of Roman politics. But it wasn't just the state and military leaders who benefited. Private contractors and suppliers profited from the Roman military campaigns, supplying food, equipment, and other necessities. This aspect is reminiscent of the modern defense industry, where profits play a significant role in political decision-making. Another important aspect was the integration of conquered territories into the Roman system. This process often required a continuous military presence and administration, further entrenching the military's role in Roman society. And let's not forget the land grants for veterans, a policy that tied the military to the economic development and sometimes led to conflicts over land and influence. On the other side of this debate was what I call stability focus. This perspective was about consolidating and effectively governing the vast territories Rome already controlled. Proponents of this view argued that the empire had reached a point where its size was becoming a liability. They emphasized the need to focus on internal issues, manage the complexities of a vast empire, and ensure stability within Rome's borders. This meant investing in infrastructure, administration, and the welfare of Roman citizens. Figures like Augustus Caesar, though an expansionist in his early years, later shifted focus to internal development and governance. His reign marked a period of relative peace and stability known as the Pax Romana. Under this paradigm, the emphasis was on building roads, aqueducts, and cities, and reforming the Roman legal and administrative systems. The goal was to create a sustainable empire, not just a vast one. This dichotomy between war and stability is still very present in modern political discourse. It's reminiscent of debates between interventionist foreign policies and isolationist or non-interventionist principles. The parallels to modern US foreign policy, in particular, are striking. The US has often faced the choice between expansionist policies, both military and economic, and a focus on internal stability and consolidation. The motivations for expansion, such as creating buffer zones against perceived or real threats, or the financial incentives of military engagement, echo the Roman experience. Likewise, the economic interdependence with military activity, where industries and jobs are tied to defense spending, mirrors Rome's reliance on the spoils of war and military production. Concluding our exploration of the political schisms in ancient Rome, we delve into the contrast between patrician and plebeian interests, a division rooted in legal privileges by birthright versus the pursuit of a more balanced legal status. The patricians, Rome's aristocratic elite, enjoyed a host of inherent legal privileges that stemmed directly from their birthright. They were the original Roman citizens, the founding families of Rome, and this lineage gave them an exclusive grip on political and religious offices. This was a society where your family name largely determines your place in the political hierarchy. Patricians had exclusive access to certain political roles, such as high-ranking positions in the Senate and key religious offices. They wielded significant influence in decision-making processes and legislation. These privileges extended beyond politics into everyday life. Patricians often had exclusive rights to certain properties and were afforded special protections under Roman law. Their social status granted them a level of immunity and respect that the common plebeians simply could not access. On the other side of this social divide were the plebeians. Initially, plebeians were almost entirely excluded from the formal political process. They were Roman citizens, yes, but citizens without the privileges that came with patrician birth. This meant no access to the Senate, no influence in the major religious institutions, and significantly fewer protections under the law. The plebeians, however, were not a group to remain passive. Over time, they fought for and gradually achieved more rights and a more balanced legal status within Roman society. This struggle is exemplified in the conflict of the orders, a prolonged period of social and political upheaval where the plebeians sought greater representation and legal equality. Key milestones in this struggle included the establishment of the Tribune of the Plebs, an office created to protect plebeian interests. The Twelve Tables, Rome's earliest code of laws, were also a significant achievement, providing a written legal standard that applied to both patricians and plebeians. Over time, the plebeians gained the right to hold political and religious offices, breaking the patricians' monopoly on power. Based on the four schisms, we could theoretically create 16 combinations. In other words, 16 separate ideologies. But as you may have noticed, there are certain overlaps between these political schisms. In theory, one could be a supporter of the redistribution of wealth while supporting the idea of maintaining inherited legal privileges. I'm sure there were some who held this belief, but in reality, your view on one were likely to determine your position on the other. So while in theory, numerous combinations could exist, in practice, the political landscape consisted of four primary ideologies. These ideologies represent the most common stances in Roman politics, each a combination of views on the central questions of governance, society, military, and law. Now, take a look at our political compass of ancient Rome. The vertical axis represents the social and class divide. At the top, the optimates and patrician interests, representing the elite's desire for control and order. At the bottom, the populares and plebeian interests, representing the common man's desire for recognition. The horizontal axis represents the debate over Rome's governance and territorial ambitions. To the left, we have the ideologies favouring imperial rule and military expansion, those who believed that Rome's destiny was to rule far and wide, and that one strong emperor or leader was the key to such a grand vision. To the right, we see the republican ideals and stability focus, those who valued self-governance, the principles of the republic, and the consolidation of what Rome had already achieved. In this landscape, we find our four predominant ideologies. In the top left quadrant, we encounter the elite imperials. Here, the ideologies of the optimates and patricians converge with the concept of imperial rule and an urge for military conquest. They represent an authoritarian approach, where the elite not only hold the reins of power, but do so with the belief that a strong empire is one that is ever expanding, ever asserting its dominance. They are the champions of the status quo, but only insofar as it serves their interests and the expansion of Roman influence. Then there are the conservative senators. They present a blend of the optimates and patricians' ideals, with a commitment to the republican model and a focus on stability. They are the traditionalists, the conservatives who see value in the institutions that have served Rome well. Their vision of governance is one where change comes through evolution, not revolution, and where the state's role is to maintain order and protect the legacy of the Roman Republic. The Republic Guardians, in contrast, held fast to the populares' vision of giving power to the people, but within the framework of a republican system. They were the advocates for a decentralized government, emphasizing political and economic reforms that would distribute power more evenly. Their approach was one of cautious non-intervention, focusing Rome's energies on internal stability and democratic principles. In modern terms, they were a mix of progressives and libertarians, wary of overreach both at home and abroad. Lastly, the popular imperators combine the people-focused perspective of the populares with the centralized power of an imperial system and a drive for military expansion. They were the ancient world's embodiment of authoritarian populism in their advocacy for social reforms and plebeian interests, yet imperial in their embrace of a strong, singular authority. They saw Rome not just as a city or a state, but as the head of a grand empire, one that required decisive leadership to navigate the complex realities of the ancient world. In each of these ideologies, we find not just a random set of policies, but a worldview, a comprehensive approach to the questions that have perennially faced those in power. How shall we govern? What is the role of the state? Who benefits from its actions? And what is our vision for the future? Now that we have defined and explored the ideological territories within the ancient Roman political landscape, let's place some of Rome's most influential figures on our political compass. This will give us some practical insight into how their personal beliefs and political actions aligned with the ideologies we've uncovered. In the elite imperials quadrant, we find individuals who were the embodiment of optimates and patrician values, fervently supporting imperial governance and military expansion. Their placement here is no coincidence. It reflects their unwavering commitment to a Rome where the central power is paramount and the reach of its empire boundless. Sulla, located near the extreme edge of this quadrant, represents the archetype of the authoritarian ruler within the Roman context. His position reflects his radical reforms and the extreme measures he took to consolidate power, including the unprecedented step of marching on Rome and assuming dictatorial powers. As dictator, he also curbed the power of the Tribune of the Plebs, the very office designed to protect the interests of the common people. By weakening this institution, Sulla undermined a key check against the authority of the Senate and the elite, thereby shifting the balance of power significantly towards the patrician class. These actions led to substantial centralization of authority, firmly setting the stage for the emergence of the empire. His proximity to the axis of imperial rule reflects his central role in shifting Rome away from the republican model. To Sulla's credit, and the reason he's not at the very furthest left edge of this quadrant, he did resign as dictator a year before his death, which is commonly believed to have been an act of integrity. He had pledged to step down once his reforms were implemented, and he followed through on this promise. Crassus, while sharing Sulla's affinity for power and influence, is placed slightly towards the centre, signifying a balance between his political manoeuvres within the late republic structures and his personal quest for military glory and wealth. His infamous role in the suppression of the Spartacus rebellion illustrates his capacity for ruthless efficiency and underscores his tendency towards authoritarianism, reflecting an imperialistic and expansionist mindset. Yet his involvement in the First Triumvirate, alongside Julius Caesar and Pompey, suggests a more nuanced approach to power that straddled the lines between the established senatorial order and the personal accumulation of wealth and military success. Despite his plebeian origins, Crassus's vast fortune and political influence aligned him more closely with the patrician elite, though his actions occasionally supported populist values, especially in his competitive relationship with Pompey and his rivalry with the Senate. Augustus Caesar, also known as Octavian, is placed near the top but closer to the centre axis than Sulla. Augustus's nuanced approach to power consolidated the imperial system while retaining the veneer of republican forms and traditions. His reign initiated the Pax Romana, a period of relative peace and stability that required both an expansionist outlook and an appreciation for the benefits of stability. His placement within the quadrant indicates his pivotal role as the bridge between the old republic and the new imperial order, highlighting his very obvious affinity for expansionism with a strategic sense of consolidation. Augustus adeptly managed the intricacies of Roman politics, balancing the interests of both the patrician and plebeian classes, while subtly reinforcing the established social hierarchy. He was a master of political symbolism, reviving and reforming Roman religious practices to bolster his regime, and skillfully presented himself as a restorer of the republic, cleverly masking his autocratic power. His actions and policies reflect a deep understanding of the complexities of Roman society and politics, making him a central player in the transition from republic to empire. Finally, Pompey the Great is plotted further towards the centre of the compass, reflecting his more varied political career. While he certainly sought military conquests and enjoyed tremendous influence, his occasional cooperation with figures like Julius Caesar indicate a degree of pragmatism and willingness to work within shifting political landscapes. His position acknowledges both his military ambitions and his contributions to the governance of the Republic before its transformation into the Empire. Pompey's career was characterized by a blend of optimati and popular policies. Initially a supporter of Sulla and the senatorial elite, Pompey later sought popular support to secure command in the war against the pirates and in the East, displaying his adaptability to the political currents. Despite his plebeian origins, his actions and alliances often aligned him with the patrician class and the political establishment. However, his support of the Lex Manilia, which granted him proconsular powers in the East, indicated his imperial tendencies. To some degree, Pompey's role in the dying days of the Republic was that of a conservative general who championed the Republic's institutions, but his actions contributed to their erosion. These figures, by their actions and legacies, underscore the intricate dynamics of power and governance that defined the elite imperials. Their relative positions within the quadrant not only signify their shared ideology, but also reflect the subtle differences in their approaches to achieving and wielding power. In the top right quadrant of our Roman political compass, the conservative senators stand as guardians of the Republic's traditions and the status quo. Cicero is positioned here, not at the very top, but firmly within this quadrant, illustrating his deep commitment to the Republic and its institutions of his time. Despite potential personal gains, he was a vocal opponent of the concentration of power in the hands of a few, as seen in his opposition to Julius Caesar and the First Triumvirate, which he viewed as a threat to the Republic's stability. At the same time, Cicero advocated for the Senate's authority, embodying the ideals of the optimati, who sought to maintain the status quo and the oligarchic power structure. While Cicero was capable of connecting with the masses through his oratory, and did champion some causes of the common people, he was by no means a man of the people. Cicero was not an expansionist either, preferring the stability and continuation of Rome's traditional institutions over the uncertainties of conquest and imperial ambition. While he engaged with both patricians and plebeians, his political manoeuvres favoured the conservative approach, working within the existing aristocratic framework rather than seeking popular reforms advocated by the populares. His oratorical skills were employed in defending the Republic against what he perceived as internal threats like Catiline, further illustrating his commitment to a stable and orderly government. Cato the Younger's position near the uppermost edge of the quadrant underscores his unwavering commitment to the principles of the old Republic. His placement here is not just a statement of his political allegiance, but an embodiment of his entire worldview. Cato's relentless opposition to the concentration of power in the hands of individuals like Julius Caesar paints him as the embodiment of the conservative senators. His advocacy for traditional Roman virtues and the existing class structure, where patrician lineage dictated societal standing, cements his role as a defender of the status quo. Despite his very conservative values, Cato's support for increasing the grain dole and his role as a tribune of the plebs may appear contradictory, but were rooted in his desire to preserve the Republic. The grain dole expansion was a strategic measure to ease social unrest and strengthen the Senate's position. Generally, he had a knack for using popular measures for conservative ends. His service as a tribune of the plebs allowed him to influence legislation in a manner that aligned with his view of the Republic and its patrician-led hierarchy. His extreme measures, including his tragic end, signify a resistance to change that is both profound and deeply rooted in the Republican ideals of governance by the Senate and not by a singular ruler. Marcus Aurelius, while situated as emperor 200 years after the fall of the Republic, is also placed in this quadrant, although further from the edge than Cato. Aurelius upheld republican ideals within the framework of an imperial system he inherited, as seen in his respect for the Senate and commitment to legal equality and freedom. He maintained the imperial authority he was appointed to hold while advocating for a government that prioritized the freedom of the governed. Marcus Aurelius's reign was more characterized by a focus on stability rather than expansionism. While he did lead military campaigns, such as those against the Marcomanni, these were largely defensive actions to protect the empire's borders rather than aggressive conquests. His Stoic philosophy inclined him towards maintaining the empire's stability and well-being rather than seeking to expand it. This approach is consistent with his overall governance style, which emphasized the well-being of the Roman state and its people, as well as the freedom and moral development of individuals over the pursuit of personal power and expansion of territory. In other words, his position suggests a more moderate approach within the conservative quadrant, an emperor who administered with a republican spirit, valuing the harmony and well-being of the empire over personal aggrandizement or territorial conquest. In modern terms, Cicero, Cato the Younger, and the philosopher King can be seen as the gatekeepers of tradition, holding back the tides of rapid change in favour of considered incremental progress. They serve as the counterbalance to the more radical elements within Roman society, providing a stabilizing force against the political upheaval and the constant push for expansion and reform. In the bottom right quadrant of our Roman political compass, we find the Republic Guardians, advocates for the populares and plebeian causes within a staunchly republican framework, emphasizing internal stability and governance. Gaius Marius was a Roman general, statesman, and member of Tribune of the Plebs, noted for his military victories and political career. Marius was an influential figure in Roman politics, pushing through a law to limit aristocratic interference in elections, underlining his populist leanings. His military reforms, including the inclusion of non-property-owning citizens in the legions, further aligned him with the Popularis faction and plebeian interests. His tenure in Spain, focused on subduing banditry and enforcing Roman rule, underscores his commitment to the stability and maintenance of the Republic's provinces. However, the trajectory of Marius's career also took a turn towards assertive control and military might. His latter years saw him employing increasingly autocratic tactics, especially in the face of political rivalry with Sulla. During this period, Marius's actions contributed to internal strife within Rome, leading to violent purges that primarily targeted the senatorial and equestrian classes. Despite this, his underlying policies did not overtly oppress the commoners, suggesting that his roots in the Populares movement remained with him throughout his life. Marius' location in the Republic Guardians quadrant mainly reflects his early career and reforms that expanded the army to non-landowners and his efforts to reduce aristocratic influence in elections. His position close to the Green Quadrant acknowledges his later actions that disrupted the Republic's stability and verged on imperatorial behaviour, especially during the civil wars and his return to power in Rome. The Gracchus brothers, Tiberius and Gaius, sit firmly in the quadrant of the Populares and plebeians due to their populist agenda aimed at societal reforms. They championed the redistribution of public land to alleviate the disparities between patricians and the lower classes, going directly against the interests of the patrician elite. Their popular stance is also evidenced by their support for measures such as the grain subsidy, which provided food at subsidized prices, and their efforts to curb the financial burdens on soldiers. The Gracchi sought to work within the existing republican framework. They preferred legal and systemic change through the legislative assemblies, as opposed to relying on military force or autocratic rule, differentiating them from, say, likes of Julius Caesar, who combined populism with imperial ambition. However, while they sought to enact changes within the republican framework, their approach, particularly Tiberius's end run around the Senate by appealing directly to the plebeian assembly, began a trend of political violence and instability in the Republic. This escalation in political conflict set a dangerous precedent, ultimately contributing to the Republic's decline and the rise of autocratic rule, even if that wasn't their intention. This careful navigation through the Republic's structures, even as they pushed for significant social changes, suggests a political approach that sought to balance the plebeian cause with a respect for Republican traditions. Spartacus, while a rebel slave rather than a traditional political leader, earns a distinctive place within this political compass. His inclusion is not just due to his status as a leader of a slave uprising, but also because he represents the ideal values of the Republic Guardians' ideology, a broader recognition of rights for those at the absolute margins of society. Spartacus's ability to unite disparate groups of oppressed individuals into a cohesive force speaks to his exceptional coalition-building abilities. His position along the plebeian axis is indicative of his fight for recognition of the lowest social classes within the Roman system. Unlike many of his contemporaries on the compass, Spartacus did not pursue personal political power. His rebellion was a direct response to systemic brutality. We don't really know Spartacus's motivations with absolute certainty. However, various indicators suggest that his rebellion was more likely a fight for freedom than a quest for personal power. The historical records we do have do not depict Spartacus proclaiming himself as a ruler or engaging in the typical power consolidations of the time. Instead, his actions indicated an intent to lead his followers away from Italy to freedom, which aligns with a goal of emancipation rather than a desire to seize power within the Roman system. The defensive nature of his military tactics, the lack of attempts to capture significant political positions in Rome, and his focus on the welfare and training of his followers all point towards a leader aiming to liberate rather than to use his forces for personal aspirations. Spartacus's placement on the political compass is not all the way to the right, because although he led a massive rebellion, there is no clear evidence that he advocated for a decentralized form of government. Moreover, his rebellion undeniably disrupted the stability of Rome, showing that he did not prioritize maintaining the status quo of the Roman Republic. His actions were more about the immediate goal of ending slavery for himself and his followers, rather than advocating for a particular political philosophy or structure. The individuals in the Republic Guardian's quadrant represent a Rome that is both progressive and conservative, a Rome that seeks to address social inequities and expand the rights of all citizens while maintaining the established republican structures and avoiding the pitfalls of tyranny. Their ideologies are rooted in the belief that the Republic's survival depends on its ability to reform and to adapt without losing its core principles and structure. In the bottom left quadrant of our compass, we find the popular imperators. These are leaders who combined a populist agenda with imperial governance and a penchant for military conquest. They resonate with the voices of the masses and embody the authoritative yet populist rule, representing a unique blend of plebeian advocacy within the construct of an expansive empire. In this quadrant, we find a solitary yet pivotal figure, Julius Caesar. His placement here is both significant and symbolic, representing his unique fusion of popularis advocacy with imperial ambition and military prowess. We see a man who understood the power of the people and harnessed it to bolster his own position. His early career was marked by a keen sense of populism, often siding with the plebeians against the traditional senatorial power structures. Therefore, Julius Caesar is situated towards the lower end of the quadrant, closer to the populares and plebeian interests, reflecting his populist policies and efforts to address the concerns of Rome's lower classes. Caesar's reforms, which included laws that protected the indebted and land redistribution and support for veterans, endeared him to the common people and secured his base of power. He also initiated public works projects that created jobs and improved living conditions in Rome, further solidifying his position as a champion of the populares cause. Caesar's placement towards the left of this quadrant reflects his gradual pivot from mere political advocacy to authoritative rule. His clever use of the tribune of the plebs to pass laws when the Senate resisted, his formation of the first triumvirate to consolidate power, and ultimately his role as dictator, demonstrate a masterful, albeit contentious, navigation of Roman politics. His military campaigns, most notably in Gaul, also solidifies his reputation as an expansionist. These campaigns not only extended the borders of Rome, but also filled its coffers and increased Caesar's personal clout, allowing him to return to Rome not just as a leader of the people, but as a commander with an army loyal to him alone. His subsequent civil war and assumption of power marked the end of the Republic in all but name. Other honourable mentions who might share this ideological space with Caesar are fleeting in their association, overshadowed by the sheer magnitude of Caesar's impact. Figures such as Publius Clodius Pulcher, an initially patrician agitator turned populist, who instigated sweeping reforms like the grain dole, directly aligning with the interests of the plebeians and escalating class tensions in the late Republic, and Lucius Cornelius Cinna, a supporter of Gaius Marius with his own populist agenda, both exhibited traits of popular imperators in their pursuit of power and reform. But it is Caesar who stands as the epitome of this quadrant. His dual legacy as a champion of the people and an architect of empire encapsulates the essence of the popular imperators. His life's journey, from the political arenas of Rome to the battlefields of Gaul, and ultimately to the steps of the Senate where his life met a violent end, embodies the perpetual struggle between populist intentions and the allure of absolute power. As we wrap up our journey through the political ideologies of ancient Rome, it's important to remember that while there are parallels to the modern-day political compass, we must be cautious not to draw direct one-to-one comparisons. The Roman world was marked by its own unique culture and challenges, and while some political themes may seem eternal, their expressions were distinct products of their time. The institutions and political maneuvers of ancient Rome can offer us shadows of modern concepts like citizenship, representative democracy, and constitutional law. Lucius Julius Caesar's Lex Julia, for instance, was a significant step toward broader citizenship that would resonate through the ages. Yet, it was also a product of Roman society's specific needs and dynamics, different in context from our contemporary practices. The Tribune of the Plebs provided a voice for the common people in a way that foreshadowed modern representative bodies. However, the role these tribunes played, the powers they held, and the society they operated within were deeply rooted in the Roman experience, distinct from the structures of modern governance. Roman legal codes, like the 12 Tables, laid the groundwork for the rule of law, predating the constitutional frameworks that govern states today. They provided a blueprint that has informed countless systems of justice, but they were tailored to a society vastly different from our own. In grappling with the expansion of their republic and the integration of diverse peoples into an empire, the Romans addressed issues of identity and cohesion, themes that are undoubtedly familiar to us. But the solutions they sought and the outcomes they experienced were inextricably tied to their unique historical moment. And as we contemplate the transition from the Roman Republic to the Empire, we are reminded of the delicate balance that must be struck in any political system between ambition and restraint, between change and continuity. The history of Rome is a rich source of stories from which we can extract valuable lessons. It teaches us that while the quest for a just and free society is a universal pursuit, the paths to achieving it are varied and influenced by each society's distinct culture and challenges. In reflecting on the past, we gain not only knowledge but also wisdom, the wisdom to appreciate the complexity of our own political landscape and the insight to navigate it with a discerning eye toward both history's cautionary tales and its inspirational examples. Rome is both distant and surprisingly familiar. It's a legacy that we continue to build upon and one that we invite you to further explore with us. If you've enjoyed this analysis and would like to be part of our mission to produce enriching historical content, consider supporting us on Patreon. Your patronage is what allows us to continue creating videos. Thank you for watching. Until next time, let the lessons of the ancients illuminate the path to our future.